You are listening to the weekly Cybersecurity Podcast, episode number 7, summarizing security news and items of interest for the week ending the 15th of July. So let's get started. I'm Brendan from the ABSH Group in Melbourne, Australia.
And I'm Stuart from Velocity in Hong Kong.
If this is your first time listening, thanks for coming. Our aim is to produce this every week. Come back often and feel free to add this to your favorite podcast app. Stuart.
Well, Brendan, yeah, what a week. It was certainly an interesting week for the Android crowd. Pokemon has stormed the world in a big way, no?
Absolutely. I mean, there was business news around it. There was technology news around it. As I was saying just before the show, I was on a train on the way to the football yesterday, and I can't tell you the amount of people of all ages, young, old, you know, running around like idiots with their iPhones out. In fact, I had four people sitting in the chair behind me, and the app dropped out at the same time, and they're like, oh, mine just dropped out.
I actually heard I was listening to a podcast, and they were saying that Pokemons have been shown in number 10 Downing Street, which means someone there is actually also playing, and it's not actually officially launched in the UK yet. So.
And that brings us to our first topic of discussion, I guess. How did that person manage to install an application that's not technically released in that country on their device?
Well, that's I guess we'll get onto that in the later down there in terms of when we talk about the malware around this. But one of the interesting things about Pokemon, of course, was that they had a bit of a boo-boo to start with. The initial launch, it was requesting all permissions to their Google account, which meant that the Pokemon Go could actually send email on your behalf, view and delete Google Drive documents, all sorts of things. And it was kind of like we didn't really mean to do that. And they released an update fairly soon afterwards.
Yeah, except there was a little bit of confusion on that update. Like, I think there were people writing in saying you had to log out and then log in, and some were saying you have to remove the app and reinstall it to reset those permissions. It wasn't quite as straightforward as just I will release an update and you install it and your permissions are being reset.
And of course there was going back to your initial comment, and of course what happened was that there was a special fake Pokemon app, or I should say a Pokemon app with a few extra additional features added to it. Namely a remote access Trojan.
Yeah.
And of course, this became an issue because the game was actually only originally launched in a couple of countries, including Australia and New Zealand. But of course, it was Pokemon's have, you know, been a massive franchise globally, and so that there were game sites everywhere that were saying, "Oh yeah, this is how you do it. So you've got to turn off your security features on Android so that you can sideload an app and then download the actual APK from a number of different third-party sites." And of course, some of those sites had the not so friendly version of Pokemon.
And wasn't it interesting? I mean, they said that it was 72 hours from when the game was released for the first fake version to appear on those third-party sites. I mean, that is a staggering turnaround time.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's like the old days, right? I mean, I remember certainly when I was younger and you get, you know, some big title get released, and there was always a race with the cracker gangs to see who could crack the anti-copy systems on it and release it onto the bulletin board systems, or sort of in the early days of the internet onto the internet sites as well. So I guess we're sort of in some ways back to that kind of thing for something that's sort of as massively popular as Pokemon Go.
Yeah. And for those listening, just to repeat and reinforce, the Nintendo and how do you pronounce that? Niantic?
Niantic, I think, yeah.
They have...
Or Niantic.
...released... They did update the permissions for the game for users on Android, so it only requires your basic account information, name and email address, I think. And if you are concerned about it, certainly either log out, log back in, or remove the app and reinstall it to ensure those permissions are effective.
And of course, for anyone that's listening from a non-officially released country, be very careful about anything that you don't get from the official, you know, Google Play Store in the case of people using the Google Android phones. And of course, same with that, you know, sometimes a little bit of patience may not be such a bad thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would almost go now as far as to say, really, you want to stick to the official stores. It's just, it's a minefield,
yeah, I mean,
unless you're technically capable. I think the chances of you navigating
the
threat landscape there is almost impossible.
Even the official stores, you know, do get quite a few bit of stuff that slips through occasionally as well. So, you know, it's certainly there are people actively trying to get past these things, and getting something for third-party sites is in a lot of ways just asking for trouble.
Shall we talk about the malware and
what
it
does? Oh yes, we've got a nice little roundup video, or nice little roundup of all sorts of malware this week, don't we?
Yeah, we sure do. So obviously there was the DroidJack, which was not new. That's been around for a while, I believe. It's just another remote access tool installed when you installed the fake Pokemon app and allows them to download other apps onto your device to increase the popularity of their app and make it look more official. Steal your information, browse other websites, use your device to promote malware to others.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised too. I mean, there's a number of sort of routing devices now for Android as well, so I wouldn't be surprised if some of them try to automatically do that.
And then there was RANSCAM.
This is a good one.
Yes, very, very interesting malware. It simply deletes users' files even if the victim chooses to pay, so it's like the previous crypto variants that we've seen in the past, except it says we've moved your data to a hidden partition, and if you pay the ransom, we'll recover them for you. Except it's already deleted the files, and on paying the ransom, it just deletes everything and shuts your machine down.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing because, you know, a lot of the ransomware is actually they work on the basis that they have a good reputation for actually giving you your files back, because if they got a reputation for not doing that, people would stop paying the ransom.
Yep.
So this is actually essentially probably a bunch of new guys that can't even be frankly asked to figure out how to do the sort of the crypto stuff properly, and just trying to they're running on the reputation of other ransomwares rather than actually doing the work themselves. And so this is probably basically they're probably a novice group, fly by night. They're going to rack up a little bit of money fairly quickly and then disappear. Unfortunate, but certainly not unexpected. And in fact, I recall actually writing about this kind of thing being possible months ago. So it's very unfortunate for those that get caught. But again, backup.
Oh, yeah. The number one deterrent has got to be effective backup strategy, without a doubt. It was interesting.
Yeah.
There was I was reading, I can't remember what article, but they were saying that one of the hospitals got done twice. They got hit, they got cleaned, and then they got hit again.
Yeah, well, that might be a third or fourth time too, so I guess they need to get their security awareness up and running.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. In fact, also there was one of the other major crypto variants. Now, I can't remember if it was CryptXXX or Lockie or the other one, but one of them, their payment system went down. So there was clients that were getting the ransomware and trying to pay, but the payment system was down, so they couldn't actually pay. And at the same time, the customer service system was down too. So they not only could they not pay, they also couldn't reach out to them for support. So
yeah, well, that's been one of the sort of things that I guess has hit a few people in the past, because obviously, you know, the law authorities and the and the various sort of anti-malware groups, the AV companies and security researchers and all the rest of it, obviously are actively trying to take some of these things down.
Yeah.
And of course, you will get people that are caught in the crossfire. If the command and control systems are taken offline, and you actually want to pay the ransom to get your files back, it's sort of like, sort of tough luck in a lot of ways. So it's a little bit tough for people. And hopefully, well, I shouldn't say hopefully, but hopefully the people that did pay ended up getting their files back in this case. But this is sort of one of the risks, even that if you want to pay the ransom, that sometimes you may find you're out of luck, because there has been people that have effectively managed to take the systems offline.
Yeah, and it's what's the word I'm looking for? It can be quite frustrating, because a lot of those cryptos increase the ransom, 24 hours
yes.
increases and 24 hours and it increases. So you're yeah. sitting there waiting for the system to come back online, and instead yeah. of 2 Bitcoin, it's 10 Bitcoin. It's a
yeah, we actually, I know someone who got whacked by that earlier this year. In fact, it wasn't so much that the system was offline. It was that, they went to buy some Bitcoins, and of course you've got to, you sign up to this Bitcoin trading site or whatever you want to call it, and set up your wallet and all the rest of it, and then you give them some credit card details, and they say, "Oh yes, because you're a new user, we can't release the Bitcoins for 48 hours while we check to make sure that this isn't a reported bad credit card or something like that." And so immediately the ransom doubled in the time of waiting to actually buy the actual Bitcoins. Was a bit annoying, but that was not one of those things that happens.
Yeah, again, backups. But some good news this week also on the crypto front.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what gets done with this. This one was obviously the academics building an early warning ransomware system. So they believe they found a system that is 100% effective against a number of, they say 500 real-world samples from 14 distinct families of crypto drop stuff, where they're actually focusing on how ransomware transforms the data rather than the execution of code. So when they see a number of files suddenly changing, and that the files are not sort of, normally when you edit a file, you do a minor change to it, okay? Maybe you add some text to it, or you add some stuff in the middle, so there'll be some kind of, I guess, some kind of transformation analysis, mathematical code that they're running here. And of course, when you actually encrypt a file, you're making it totally different. There's no relationship to the earlier version of it. So what they've been able to do is to come up with some mathematical formula to sort of detect and deal with this. And so as soon as a ransomware starts starts working on a machine, they can very quickly detect it's doing that, and then terminate the process. So it's an interesting, and also I guess it'll see how this gets developed into real world protections, because obviously this is obviously just early academic stuff at the moment.
Yeah.
But
I must admit, when I was reading through the paper, I was like, "Where's the download link?" I just want to download this thing and get it started.
It's probably going to be months. This is obviously just an early testing thing. It's going to be months before this stuff maybe makes it out into the real world. And then, of course, then the crypto guys will probably try to figure out how to detect and nuke this kind of thing as well. I mean, it's like the old days. I don't know if you remember, but used to get the viruses that used to seek out the AV programs and corrupt them. So.
Yeah, but they did say in the paper, though, that the evasion will be incredibly difficult because the technique they're using relies on three independent indicators. And to avoid one, you will increase the likelihood of the other two. So whilst they said it's not impossible, they said it would require a much deeper understanding of modern file systems, which means, I guess, it's going to be limited to those really hardcore groups that are actually developing this stuff at the low-level code point, not just the script kiddies that are buying the code on the market and then adjusting it for their own benefit.
Yeah.
But it sounds like...
Or you just seek out the protection system and stop that.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it runs as a... they're injecting it as a system what was it, a kernel?
A kernel level driver. Yeah, it'd have to be. Yeah.
So it's going to take some effort. Not that it's not possible, but it's certainly going to take some effort to knock that out. And the speed at which it could do it, I guess, is the other thing too. You know, what kind of tax is that going to have on your system performance? And I think the last major hurdle for them is at the moment it still very much relies on manual intervention, you know, when they're detecting it, saying, is this, are you zipping something? Are you doing something? But, I think the world would certainly welcome something like this, because really to date there's been nothing else in the market. And I was talking, I was reading through a couple of the researchers' posts, and they're certainly in talks now. They're seeking commercial interest to try and get it to market. So,
Well, now that they've actually stated what they're doing, I wouldn't be surprised if there'll be other people that try to replicate their work too. So.
I was saying, I bet you there's a whole bunch of people at Semantic and Webroots and Sophos and all the AV companies now tasking up a whole bunch of engineering teams saying, right, this is how we do it, let's get cracking.
Yeah. Yep.
What have we got our News Bites section this week?
What do we have here? We have a couple of...
That Black Hat stats were interesting.
Yeah, that was interesting. The 72% of security professionals that attended Black Hat. So these are security professionals, people that live and breathe this stuff for the most part, expect a major data breach at their own organizations in the next 12 months. So that was basically their belief that the bad guys are going to be more successful at attacking than what they will be at defending, which is obviously not a great sign.
It does show the threat landscape, or the current... the current landscape, you know, it's all about mitigating the risk, I guess, and trying to lessen the impact as opposed to completely avoid.
Yeah. Well, 2/3 of them said that they just didn't have enough staff, enough budget, or enough training to adequately address the ever-growing threat landscape. And the most common complaint was just a shortage of qualified people and skills, which is, obviously one of the big concerns. And that sort of goes back to a report I remember reading last year when I was doing some research for the chapter of the book I wrote, where Gartner was saying that they estimated by the end of next year there'd be a shortage, global shortage, of over 2 million cybersecurity professionals, which is, that just shows that this is an industry which is rapidly falling short of what it needs in terms of, the threats are increasing, and it takes a period of time to, it's very much a asymmetric landscape. You know, you can have one small group of attackers that are attacking hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of companies via the internet, whereas each one of those companies needs to have their own, defense resources.
Yep. It's certainly tough. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of clients I talk to weekly, and their number one complaint around security is always that, just not enough resources. And even the ones that have the resources, they say the same thing. You know, the landscape changes so rapidly that they're constantly talking to vendors. I got one guy who said he had 23 different vendor security products that made up his client defense system. He was just of the opinion, whatever it is, I'll take it. I just, the more defense, the more sandbags, the more military personnel, the more tanks, the more laser guns you can buy. He just put them all in and hope for the best. But you have your own other problems around performance and management, and the vulnerabilities that those particular products also introduce. So then you've got to patch them, you've got to manage them. It's a tough.
And that's more people and more resources. And
outage windows was another one. I've got some big clients, and they just can't. They're not like small business. They just can't take systems offline, even for 3 to 5 minutes for a reboot. That's got to all be scheduled in. And it's tough.
It
leads us into our next topic, which is patch management and news bites around what's been happening in the last week.
Yeah, well, of course, this week was MS Patch Tuesday, the monthly patch fiesta from both Microsoft and, of course, Adobe as well. And, of course, Microsoft had a number of patches that they've released, including a couple of critical ones, which could allow for remote code execution, although the reports I saw on those is it's pretty hard to make use of those, although, obviously, you know, that is still any remote code execution vulnerability is something that needs to be patched ASAP. And then, of course, our old friends at Adobe with Flash, favorite program of the month for hackers to attack. They had 52 flaws in Flash that were fixed on their updates on Tuesday. So it's certainly been a busy week for those of us having to do patches.
Yes. Now, there was also some feedback I saw on one of the forums I follow around the patches for the Microsoft knowledge base articles that's causing some issues for them. So if you are going to deploy those patches, again, follow best practices, deploy it to a couple of test sources first, and then all going well, do a staged rollout depending on your environment.
Yeah, you have to do that now that the speed that everything is done these days just means that the things can get through sometimes. And of course, there's been a number of occasions this year where patches have had to be pulled by Microsoft and then reissued. There's a note here I saw on one of the forums, which I'll just kind of quote, basically saying here, the July 12th patch has been disastrous. All of our computers running Windows 10 never completed the patch, and the CPU disk activity is pegged at close to 100%. So, you know, that's basically ground all of their computer systems to a halt, which is obviously a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, less,
so,
less
again,
than
you know,
ideal.
Test and patch, you know, there must be some interaction there between something they're using and the patch process. You know, it could be the AV, it could be any one of those things.
Yeah.
But that just goes to show why it's important to test before you roll out on a massive scale.
All right, Stuart, I think that pretty much sums up the week.
Yep, certainly all the major stories. Yes. And it's been a busy week, certainly with all the patching and the various other things going on. And for those that are big Pokemon players, I guess they'll have to get back to reality at some point.
Yeah, well, today is Monday, so hopefully they're back at work after spending the weekend playing. As always, Stuart, thank you very much for your time.
Not a problem. I'll see you next week.
Done deal.